So I'm talking about quantum cosmology, which is a word for quantum gravity in the case that we have no boundaries in the universe, and quantum foundations from first principles. That is what I'm going to insist on, at least to myself with my own work, is to get things right from what seem to be good principles, first principles. And as you see, there are second thoughts. And I'm inviting criticism and second thoughts here. Okay. Now let's see if I can work this. Okay. What if the realists are right? Realists are people from a philosophical designation who believe that science is about what nature really is, not what we'd represent it to be, not what we think we could get away with, but what do we really think nature is? And different, Lucien, we've talked about this many times. Many of us would like to be realists. Many of us secretly are. And I don't mind confessing that I'm a realist. I want to find out what is true in the world, and that's what my goal is as a scientist. If the realists are right, now each of these is a long discussion, but I'm happy to carry it out, then quantum mechanics is wrong in the end. And that's something I think we experts, if you let me call myself that, and quantum foundations can pretty well establish that if the world can be discussed in terms of what's really real, then quantum mechanics as we study it and teach it is not completely correct. There must be some additional degrees of freedom. And those additional degrees of freedom are called hidden variables. And we've learned a lot since the 1920s about what hidden variables had to be like for the program to work. And it turns out you can make hidden variable theories that work, but you pay a big price. The price you pay is that they're highly non-local. And I'm happy to address what that means. So, but what it means is what you think it means, that you can intervene in a measurement very far away. And indeed, you have to intervene in measurements or experiments very far away. Okay? So, I'm not going to go through the history, but when we proved that hidden variable theories, if they exist, had to be non-local, was the work of John Bell. And he proved a theorem that a certain inequality had to be true experimentally if there were to be an explanation of the oddities of quantum mechanics by additional variables. So, first question, do there exist now some promising directions to make such theories? If I say my research agenda is to find or construct some non-local hidden variable theories, and that's a completely silly idea from all possible or from all experience so far, then I should somehow justify why I'm going to make that extra assertion. So I think the first thing we want to know is, yes, there are non-local hidden variable theories. And there was one which indeed existed before quantum mechanics was even invented, which is called the de Broglie theory, after its founder, de Broglie. And there are others that you may not know of, but let me mention them very selfishly, because I invented some of them. So there are a number of hidden variable theories which are non-local, which you build in the following way. You take degrees of freedom which are valued in matrices, and these are known as matrix models. Now we know a great deal about some classes of matrix models. When I started doing this, which was in the early 1980s, there were not so many known, but they turned out to be easy to find that if you took a model whose degrees of freedom were the modes of a matrix, and you took n, the dimension of the matrix, to infinity in precisely the right way, you got a hidden variable theory. And I found out a way to do that in 1983. Steve Adler, who's a great theoretical physicist, a particle physicist, found a way to do that somewhat later. Steve Adler, Fortini Marco-Pulo, and so on. So by the middle, late 1980s, we knew that we could make hidden, non-local hidden variable theories out of n to infinity matrix models. And the key idea, I'll just tell you, the idea is very simple. The beables, that is, the things that the theory denotes are true and really exist, are the matrix element, or sorry, are the eigenvalues of the matrices. And the hidden variables that are additional to the ones you measure are the matrix elements. So there are a lot of ways to make theories like that, and I'll give it to you as a homework. Now we know a lot about matrix models and a lot about the large n limit of some matrix models. So go home on the weekend and make yourself some hidden variable theories. I think they're fascinating, but I don't think they're rare. Okay. Okay, so I want to repeat something, but add one thing, which is that to do any of these matrix models, you need to put the model at a finite temperature T, and which is a and scale T to zero proportional with a certain proportionality to n going to infinity. And that's if you wanted me to explain to you how to do a particular one, that would be the main thing that I would have to explain. Now, here's a very interesting thing. When you write such a hidden variable theory, at first, the degrees of freedom are the elements of some matrices. So there's nothing local. The degrees of freedom are all equally non-local. The world, in fact, has nothing that you would call spatial degrees of freedom. The world, the Hamiltonian, the Lagrangian of the world, is made up of the degrees of freedom of the matrix elements, all equally. That way you get, by the way, of course, a UN symmetry. So there's nothing very, these models use lots and lots of techniques that we understand very well. Indeed, it was easy to invent them when I started working on them in the early 80s because there were great scientists around, like somebody who would be a great, anybody know? A great physicist from the 1980s who worked on matrix models. Anybody? Wigner? Anybody here heard of Eugene Wigner? Okay, well, we got to come back in because I'm not seeing enough. You guys should revere Eugene Wigner. He put group theory into physics. And, but anyway, Wigner was, happy to talk to anybody about group theory at that time. So it's easy to learn enough to do something. And if he wasn't enough, there was Freeman Dyson. Okay. So at leading order in 1/n, you had a model whose degrees of freedom were elements of matrices. There was no locality. There was no non-locality because there was no locality. And you just had a theory of invariables. But you could show that if you took n to 0 and t to 0, I'm sorry, n to infinity and t to 0 in the right way, you got a copy of quantum mechanics. Okay. Steve Adler did that, wrote just 2 or 3 books on the same thing at about that time. That turned out much later, this is maybe not of interest to everybody, to work with the matrices in loop quantum gravity, that is the adjacency matrices of spin networks. And the work I'm going to be telling you about rests on another framework for quantum gravity, which was invented at about the same time, called causal set theory. And so we're going to look into that in a minute. Any questions? Okay, now we're going to get moderately philosophical. I hope you don't mind. Okay, anybody who doesn't really like philosophy, you can leave for 5 or 10 minutes. But I believe that philosophy is a very strong way to motivate one's ideas in physics. Not for everybody, not by any means for everybody, but it happens to be that I find some inspiration, and I know a few other people. So this is a philosophical view about space and time called Leibnizian relationalism. Leibniz lived about the same time that Newton did, and indeed he opposed Newton's ideas, and we can get into why and how. But what you have to know is that he advocated a point of view about space and time, which was very like the point of view that Einstein, several hundred years, advocated. And we call it Leibnizian relationalism. And the next few sentences describe what it asserts. It asserts the universe contains everything that is the case. Anybody want to repeat that? Because that's the key idea. The universe contains everything that is the case. There is nothing outside the universe. Period. There is nothing that acts on it from the outside. There's nothing that you can tune dials on and from outside the universe and affect it. There are no boundary conditions. It's perfectly important to study model universes which have boundaries and boundary conditions and so forth, but Leibniz will argue that you won't get any cosmological knowledge that way. Okay, so we start with a universe we're describing that contains everything that is true. The universe also contains a large number of subsets. The intersection of the past, so I assume that elementary things like the future and the past are defined. The intersection of the past with a subset defines what we call a past neighborhood. It's a something which is adjacent in a causal sense to the universe and is to our past. And we're going to be very concerned as I build the structures here to distinguish past structures from future structures. And I want you to notice whenever I do that, I'm doing something that you're not supposed to do in a physics paper or in a physics work, which is distinguishing something which is the future of what? Of us, from something that is the past. And this is very confusing for some people. And some philosophers don't like it at all. And some physicists believe that there is no such thing as the future as a whole, because time does not fundamentally exist. But I'm going to ask you to give me the freedom to talk about the past of the universe at this moment and the future of this moment. And we'll come back and understand what that really means. Okay, so the universe contains a large number of subsets of itself, and there are intersections of a subset with the past, that is, with things that are before the present, and we call those past neighborhoods, and there are intersections with the future, and we call those future neighborhoods. Okay? The neighborhoods of every unit, of every event, are unique. This is an idea that's hard to get used to, because it's not an idea that we like in particle physics. I want to claim that if I can talk about an event, I can talk about a unique event. I want to claim that every event in the universe is unique. That is, it has a description which distinguishes it, or by which you can distinguish every other event. And that's very important. So, now, also a very important idea is that we're going to distinguish events by their neighborhoods. Okay, so you don't get to just write a physics paper and say, there is a point X, because that doesn't mean anything. You've got to write some physical description of how you can distinguish the event X from every other event. Okay, will you stick with me? That may sound strange, but I want to claim that every event in the universe can be distinguished from every other event by some observation. That means that there are an infinite number. I'll let myself to that idea. And I want to assert that the universe has many, many small subsystems, and these subsystems satisfy some rules of logic, which I'm not going to distinguish here, but they're the rules of Heiding algebras or intuitionistic logic. So the important thing is that you have enough tools to talk about all the different events in terms of what happens there, or what could be seen from there. Okay? And there are some people who've gone into that great deal. Okay, can I have, let me see if I can, something to drink. You know, I'm gonna skip over some of this, but we'll come back and go through it. There's some arguments in here which are about determinism and indefinitism and so forth, and we'll probably need to get back to them, but let me skip over them. Okay. Now we get to what philosophers call the ontology of the universe. And we are going to claim first that the universe is made of events. So that's the basic thing in the universe, is events. And we're going to notice that events happen. They don't exist. You can't say a fundamental thing in the world is that eraser over there. You have to tell me what the eraser is doing and how I can distinguish it from the eraser at other times. So the basic things in the world are going to be things that happen, and we're going to distinguish those and talk about, well, fundamental things that happen. And the important thing is I'm going to want to distinguish between things that happen in the future, things that happen in the present, and things that happen in the past. Okay, so here's how I do that. I invoke relations called causal relations. And I basically have three kinds of processes which create causal relations. I have relations to the past. So if yesterday somebody wrote you a beautiful letter, then that is to the past of your receiving the letter causally. And you don't have to get sophisticated about that. But let's distinguish events which are causally to the past of other events from events that are causally to the future of other events, from events that are neither causally past nor future. Okay, anybody want us to pause and ask a question? Okay, well, this gets more complicated, and I'll just leave this. If you start to think about the relations between these different kinds of events, remembering that we only can distinguish them by virtue of their interactions with other events. There's more here than meets the eye, but I'm not going to do everything here. Now, the causal events are fundamental. So the relation between a past causal event and a future causal event is fundamental. And I want to just take that, I've told you how to define them. I want to just take that as basic to what I'm doing. Now, consider an event and all the events that are causal to it, that are causally to the past of it. I'm sorry. So these are events which happened, quote, before the present event. And we're going to have some way to recognize that. Those events that are causally to the past change our event. Our event cannot affect them, but they affect our event. And I want to call all the events which can change our event part of the past view. So I have a special category for that. I call that the past view of my event. And it's important for the following reason. When these two events interact, one is causally to the past of the other. That one is going to influence, well, it can't influence anything because it's acting, it can't act, it's already acted on our event, and it can't act to the future of that. It acts only to the past. So events to the past of ours don't change anything. They can't change anything in the world. So they actually don't exist in any serious way. So causally past events, we're just going to leave and let them, they can't do anything. So they don't exist. The view of an event in the future, however, is a view that can affect us. And notice how it can. An event that's in the future, it's like something coming towards us. And it's going to interact with us to the future of our presence, of our present existence. And so it's going to, that's why we say it's in the future, it's going to affect us in the future. And then it has an effect on us. But the event coming from the future can't be changed and it can't be measured until it comes to us. And we'll see that that has some consequences. Okay? I'm going very fast through this. So let's come down to time, which I want to use the word time to refer to a process which is continually bringing into existence new events and passes some of the energy and momentum that it carries to this new event. So I want you to think about that. So by bringing into existence, new events, a future event will change those new events. And for a short time, it has an influence on new events being created. And then it too passes to the past. Okay, and let me see what else I want to know here from here. I want to distinguish emergent properties from fundamental properties. So an emergent property is one that is created in an interaction and doesn't just exist by virtue of being. Let me start it again. An emergent object or an emergent property is brought into existence by an event, and we'll need that. A fundamental property is always there and is not brought into existence. It's just to be there to begin with. So I think I say that. The view of an event is what the event knows of its causal past by the information passed to it from its backward light cone. Emergent properties are then those properties left behind as the future disappears, and are those that only affect the present records and then disappear into the past. So if you want to think about, there's a kind of inversion of the past, of the future, coming from the far in the future and interacting with you at a more present moment and then continuing into the past. And Heisenberg reflected on this a lot. And Heisenberg wrote, I think, two books arguing that the past has no existence on the basis of these kinds of discussions. And I feel out of breath. I feel like we're going through the whole world very quickly. But do you see the basic picture? And then we're going to draw it. Well, I haven't said anything about quantum mechanics yet, but I'm about to. So how energetic causal sets evolve. Energetic causal sets are sets which are sets of events which have causal relations amongst them and no other properties. And these were studied by Raphael Sorkin and other people in the last 20 so years. And we're adding to that this structure of energy and momentum being passed around. And we're going to put some limits on it. So in particular, we're going to have when a present event is created, it has a certain number, shall we say, of children. those are events that the event has already been responsible for creating, for contributing properties to. And we're going to put a limit, which I'll call here very unimaginatively N, of the number of children that an event can have. And we're also going to put a limit, I'll call it M, on the number of children that can be had, can be made by one event. And we're going to choose these numbers. A past event can have no more of influence on its future. And that means that a past event has already filled up its quota for having events. And that's why it can't do anything anymore in the sense of creating new events. Okay. So, any questions? By the way, this was all worked out in conversations with Roberto Mangabeira Unger and Maria Cortez between about 1915 and 2020 or something like that, and published. Those are pictures of causal sets. And what is different about what I'm calling energetic causal sets is that they each carry energy and momentum, because each of the causal links carry a certain amount of energy and momentum. And the energy and momentum, when two causal links collide to create a new present event, it takes on board the energy and momentum that it's carrying. So there's a conservation law at each event, which tells you that you have to give to your descendants exactly the amount of energy and momentum that you take. And they also, we have to prepare. These are, give us energy momentum vectors. And we are going to keep those constant and fixed. So that's the full structure. There can be more, but that's the basic full structure. Okay, now notice that my description of a universe evolving according to these rules doesn't have a notion of space. It has notions of momenta, but there's no space anywhere. And I'm going to show you next how space can, quote, in some cases emerge because of the extra structure of energy and momentum. Okay, so let's see if there's anything else I want to say. That's a vertex in an energetic causal set. We have a certain amount of energy and momentum, P and Q, and we split those into the future as we absorb them from the past. And that's just some more pictures of it. So just to summarize, we're very interested in the views of each of these events. Time is a procedure which brings into being new events in that particular way that I described to you. And now let's look at the notion of distance. There's so far no space, there's no space-time. There is a causal notion of time, which is pushing us into the causal future. And that's all we have. But we want more. We want real physics. So what would we do to make real physics from this structure? We have events, so we would write down laws that the events satisfy. But my problem is, I don't have any notion of space for those events to live in. So I'm going to just forget about that for the moment. But notice that there is something that I can use as if it were like space. And that's the difference. In other words, as I have an intervention between two or any number of events, each event involved has a view of the rest of the universe because of the energy momentum vectors coming to it. In other words, what you're allowed to use is, say we live in a three-dimensional world, then at every event, there's a collection of three-dimensional or four-dimensional vectors telling me the contributions to energy and momentum that are coming to that event. And that goes into its view. And I can take two views and compare them. That is, I can say, hey, you're way over there on that side of the room, and you look this way, what do you see? And you can say to me, what do you see? And can we compare them? And we can compare them. And there are various measures of difference of views. There are the measures of difference of patterns that the directions of the vectors make. We worked out with Julian Barber a long time ago a function which measures how different two views are, and we call it the variety. So here's a typical notion of the variety between two point sets. Each one is a collection of point sets on the two-sphere, and take one two-sphere and the other two-sphere and twist them around by a rotation until the difference between the vectors, the points in the point sets are made as little as possible. So in other words, you try to bring them together as much as you can. And if you do that for every pair of point sets that you have, and you sum them over all the pairs, that's the variety. And I can show you with some pictures, if you want, later on, what different notions of variety look like. But this has since been studied, and there are other kinds of measures, but they all come down to basically pictures of measures of complexity. Okay. So given somebody way over there looking out at their view of the universe and me looking out at my view of the universe, you can measure how different we are. And if you average that or extremize that over all ways to lay down the two spheres, you can measure how different is the universe I live in from the universe you live in. And you can do that with traffic, for example. You can do it with structures of cities. You can say, I want to live in a city that's really interesting, in which every corner is as different from every other corner as possible. And we can write to an algorithm that will find that city, that arrangement. Okay. So I think I need to move ahead. There's a question? Okay, so space goes away, and at leading order in 1 over n, what replaces space is difference.
Sorry, I have a question. Is this a story different from the analytic causal set story, or is the same continuation of the set story?
Which story? This is not new.
The thing with the blue background. Have you switched the story, or is somehow you're putting like more?
There's more coming. So far.
Okay, so this is still in the context of energetic causal sets.
Of analytic?
Energetic causal sets.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, I think you flip back. Yeah.
Yes, I see. Is that here? Oh, I see. I'm sorry. Okay, I have to. The distance is the differences. You can use this to measure degrees of emergence. You can use functions on two spheres and call that the sky. And that comes into some work which I wasn't planning to show here, but where the notion of the sky of functions on a two-sphere is getting a lot of interest these days. So we can use measures and have used measures coming from that work. And this is just summarize where we are. And then this is not the stopping point, but it's this where this work was 15 years ago. So what the point of this is that systems more likely to interact with each other are closer in space-time, and we're rejecting that idea for systems that are more diverse, are more likely to interact with each other. And that's an idea that we've been studying for some time. Okay, let's go into some new stuff. So to derive quantum mechanics, we're going to need an action principle. And we're going to use these ideas to write down a quantum mechanical system, non-relativistic in this case, for n particles in d dimensions. So dij is the distance function between two agents or two events, I and j. And they live in a set called S. And what I'm showing here is that we can define I think I have too much on this slide, but let me show you what I want to write. So is everybody familiar with the Hamilton-Jacobi function? Anybody not familiar with the Hamilton-Jacobi function? Okay. So in the Hamilton-Jacobi function, we have a dynamical system which depends on the coordinate x. And this can be the x of any dynamical system. And I'm going to write a function on the dynamical system called the action. And I'm going to define it like this. This is called statistical Hamilton-Jacobi theory. And what we're writing is that the average of the action in time is the integral dt, integral dx, s dot minus del s 2m squared. And we can stop there. Actually, I want to do one more thing. plus a function of x, which has interactions. Okay. Any questions? Well, if I want it, does anybody know how to make this quantum mechanical? Or in other words, well, you tell me what it means. Okay, Lucien, you really don't know? Okay, you have to add a new potential called the Bohm potential, where U of Bohm is h bar squared over 8m squared del s over del x squared. No, I'm sorry, rho. And believe it or not, that begins to be, that is the Schrodinger equation. Well, that's the Schrodinger wave function. So the statement is that the Schrodinger wave function satisfies the Schrodinger equation when the classical Hamilton-Jacobi function is at an extremum. Is anybody impressed? Come on, get excited, say it's boring, something. Well, the interesting thing is that the expectation value of the Hamilton, of, I'm sorry, the Bohm potential, which is this, is equal to the expectation value of the variety with some appropriate normalizations. So this is a version of quantum mechanics that says that quantum mechanics is classical mechanics of a system that tries as hard as possible to extremize its variety. And I think that's an interesting discovery. Question? Okay, so shall I tell you, just outline what else we've discovered and then bring this to a halt? Okay, but does anybody have a question?
You may have a halt because I missed that. What was the
definition of the variety of the?
The variety is, sorry, the variety is the sum over pairs, disordered pairs, I not equal to j, of events of the distance between I and J. So it's it can be more complicated than that, but that basically you sum over all triples of events and you take the extremum of the pairs of events summed over all triples. Should I say that again? You take the sum over all triples of events, and for each triple, you discover the configuration, which makes it have the least action, which is the most variety, and then you sum that over all the triples. So a maximal variety function is one that has, is an organization of a large number of bodies such that each triple is maximally organized, or has maximum variety. Why is that the exactly the Bohm function? We can come back to in another. I don't think it's too complicated to discuss here, but eventually we understood exactly why it's equal to the Bohm potential. Okay, can I mention some other things? And then I'll close. So this is non-relativistic quantum mechanics. We also have done a form of relativistic point mechanics, which is not equivalent to quantum field theory. We have understood perturbative quantum field theory, perturbative cutoff quantum field theory, and reproduced basically what the amplitudes people produce. That is, we get a perturbative sum over a diagram that looks a lot like one of the diagrams coming from the amplitude program. And we have some ideas about general relativity, but let me stop here. So I challenged you at the beginning to, and I still mean this, tell me if this is silly, stupid, obviously wrong, or if it has a chance to be real physics. And I think it's a decent attempt myself, but there's a lot to do. Yes.
Make a prediction, we cannot say if it's right or wrong.
Oh, I forgot the predictions. Yes, the next, I know this exactly, and in fact I know it to any order, and if you want me to, I'll write it down. So we do have predictions.
What are you predicting?
Can I look at something and I don't remember exactly, but it has a number, an even number of delta rho's over rho's times some coefficients. And it's in our papers.
Right, but so, in terms of what kind of observation?
Here's a crazy one. Do you want the crazy one first? Supposing we know of another civilization out there that wants to communicate with us, this would be the best way. But, I mean, well, that's sort of silly. I don't know. I can tell you that it predicts that there are new effects in quantum mechanics that grow with the distance. But I can't tell you much more than that so far. But every pi and two and factor in those corrections is fixed.
This is in a new paper, or is that just...
Some of this is in a new paper, which is coming. Some of it is, there's a lot of stuff in two new papers, which are not this, because they are attempts to realize a program which is related to this, which has to do with extending doubles, or what's it called when you have a system which has two things that mix up. Sorry. You have a help. when you have a come on, when you have a neutrino and a doublet, or a, what am I looking for? This is the most embarrassing part of this disease. Anyway, it's a symmetry amongst two things, and you extend them to a symmetry among three things. And so that looks like, if you want to have born, whatever is the word I'm looking for, and you have an integral, which is integral dx, integral dp, x dot p, that's born, help me somebody, born duality, yes, thank you. And what I know how to do is write that as a matrix trace with a certain fixed object, A. With the trace, and I know how to change this to an object with a higher symmetry, which involves three objects. And that may not seem like very impressive, but what it's looking for is to give a fair definition, or a good definition, of what we mean by background independence. That's what we're going to mean by background independence, is that you have three objects that can play the same role. And you, like there, D omega, D. So the sum turns into a sum which has a triple symmetry. And that's something that I'm very interested in, and that ties to the question of whether laws can change. And that's very much at the center of work that we're doing with these kinds of, extending these kinds of theories to theories that have triple symmetries. So you never just have doublets, you have triplets of symmetries. And we want to understand the world through a breaking of triplet symmetries down to things that have dualities. And we'll see. That's, but we have a paper coming out on that. And then there's a bunch of other things. Yes. Thank you very much. Very, very much. No. Well, not right off that I know. But I have, I don't believe that the standard version of the explanation of the second law in terms of, well, is correct. That I think that if time is going to be real, that time is fundamental, and it's fundamentally asymmetric. So I think that we should be understanding the world in a way in which time is always asymmetric. And that comes into what you're asking about.
I'm sorry, what was the first part of the question? So I think you mentioned that this predicts some effects that grow with distance in quantum mechanics.
Yes.
Can you elaborate on that, please? And if there's anything that other we see.
I think it's too hard to elaborate on. At least I'm a little tired. So let me just ask me at some other time. It basically has to do with these formulas which come from the corrections to quantum mechanics. Well, let me give you a way you might try to get at it. Supposing you had, this is a way in which you might test a wide class of quantum systems. Supposing that you had a theory which differed from quantum mechanics as n became larger and larger. Okay. So, if you compared the predictions of this theory with quantum mechanics for systems which had a small number of particles and a small number of, and again, this is a word I don't remember. Come on, the word in the quantum mechanics. Entangled. So if I have more entangled particles, I see the terms coming out of these equations as being more important because one of the ratios of the number of entangled particles to the n grows in that equation. So if I wanted to test this, I mean, it's a long shot because n is probably pretty large.
I'm curious about this relationship with Bohmian mechanics.
Good.
And I would like to understand whether you think of Bohmian mechanics as an effective version, an effective theory of what these other fundamental theories hint at. And if so, do you have a sense? So here you recover the Bohmian potential, but what about the pilot wave? So what would be...
What wave?
The pilot wave.
That's the same thing, I think.
Oh, so what would you... How would I understand the pilot wave with Bohmian mechanics as emerging from what you're saying?
Well, I have to tell you why this works, but basically... if you divide it into a power counting argument with another argument, which I, if you could make large numbers of entangled particles in a quantum system, then I'm sorry, it's not. Ask me tomorrow.
Okay. But I think, sorry, if I can continue. To our conversation, I can continue on this.
Yes.
If you want to make a connection between these theories, has been one.
Bohm and de Broglie. Yes.
So my question would be also, how do I make the two ontologies? Something that is very much like here is that you don't have particles. You have events, you have views, and in the Bohmian mechanics, you need to recover this notion of particles as being the case of ecology. So,
yes.
Connected to things.
You know, somehow I don't take Bohm seriously enough to That's not an excuse, but I don't think that. You see, Bohm involves you in believing in what are called the ghost particles or the ghost waves. And I don't find those remotely plausible. So that's why I haven't thought about it. Sure, just a few more.
Finally, one more time, and there's two downstairs.
Thank you very much.